Send Me to Sleep is a production of Slumber Studios and is made possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors and premium members. If you'd like to listen ad-free and have access to special bonus episodes, you can try out Premium Free for 7 days by following the link in the episode notes. Now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Tinder. With spring and festival season on the way, now is a fantastic time to get on Tinder and find your twin flame. You know, someone you can match festival outfits with, a boo with similar music tastes, or maybe someone who can introduce you to something new. Just make sure to throw a few likes their way, or you'll never know. Explore all of the possibilities for yourself on Tinder. It starts with a swipe. Download Tinder today.
Welcome to Send Me to Sleep, the place to find a good night's rest. My name's Andrew. Thanks for joining me, and for taking this time for yourself to ensure you get a peaceful night's sleep. Tonight, I'll be reading North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell, chapters 16 and 17. In the last chapter, a heated conversation had occurred between Margaret and Mr. Thornton surrounding the ways of the industry in the North. In these chapters, Dr. Donaldson visits the Hale household and examines Mrs. Hale. If you haven't already, find a nice place to get cozy. Take a deep, relaxing breath. And settle your body in whatever way feels most comfortable. Now all you'll need to do is follow the sound of my voice. So let your eyes fall heavy. And your breath soften. As we settle in for a peaceful night's sleep. Chapter 16. The Shadow of Death. Trust in that veiled hand, which leads none by the path that he will go, and always be for change prepared, for the world's law is ebb and flow. From the Arabic. The next afternoon, Dr. Donaldson came to pay his first visit to Mrs. Hale. The mystery that Margaret hoped their late habit of intimacy had broken through was resumed. She was excluded from the room while Dixon was admitted. Margaret was not a ready lover, but where she loved passionately and with no small degree of jealousy. She went into her mother's bedroom, just behind the drawing room, and paced it up and down, while awaiting the doctor's coming out. Every now and then, she stopped to listen. She fancied she'd heard a moan. She clenched her hands tight and held her breath. She was sure she heard a moan. Then all was still for a few minutes more, and then there was the moving of chairs and the raising of voices all the little disturbances of leave-taking. When she heard the door open, she went quickly out of the bedroom. "My father is from home, Dr. Donaldson. He has to attend a pupil at this hour. May I trouble you to come into his room downstairs?" She saw and triumphed over all the obstacles which Dixon threw in her way. Assuming her rightful position as daughter of the house, in something of the spirit of the elder brother, which quelled the old servant's officiousness very effectually. Margaret's conscious assumption of this unusual dignity of demeanour towards Dixon gave her an instant's amusement in the midst of her anxiety. She knew, from the surprise expressed on Dixon's face, how ridiculously grand she herself must be looking, and the idea carried her downstairs into the room. It gave her that length of oblivion from the keen sharpness of the recollection of the actual business at hand. Now, that came back, and seemed to take away her breath. It was a moment or two before she could utter a word. But she spoke with an air of command, and she said, "What is the matter with Mama? You will oblige me by telling me the simple truth." Then, seeing a slight hesitation on the doctor's part, she added, "I am the only child she has. Here, I mean. My father is not sufficiently alarmed, I fear, and therefore, if there is any serious apprehension, it must be broken to him gently. I can do this. I can nurse my mother. Pray, speak, sir. To see your face and not be able to read it gives me a worse dread than I trust any words of yours will justify." "My dear lady, your mother seems to have a most attentive and efficient servant who's more like her friend. I am her daughter, sir. But when I tell you she expressly desired that you might not be told, I am not good or patient enough to submit to this prohibition. Besides, I am sure you are too wise, too experienced to have promised to keep the secret." "Well," said he, half smiling, though sadly enough, "there you are right. I did not promise. In fact, I fear the secret will be known soon enough without my revealing it." He paused. Margaret then went very white and compressed her lips a little more. Otherwise, not a feature moved. With the quick insight into character, without which no medical man can rise to the eminence of Dr. Donaldson, he saw that she would exact the full truth, that she would know if one iota was withheld, and that the withholding would be torture more acute than the knowledge of it. He spoke two short sentences in a low voice, watching her all the time, for the pupils of her eyes dilated into a black horror, and the whiteness of her complexion became vivid. He ceased speaking. He waited for that look to go off, for her gasping breath to come. Then she said, "I thank you most truly, sir, for your confidence. That dread has haunted me for many weeks. It is a true, real agony. My poor, poor mother. Her lips now began to quiver, and he let her have the relief of tears, sure of her power of self-control to check them. A few tears, those were all she shed, before she recollected the many questions she longed to ask. Will there be much suffering? He shook his head. That we cannot tell. It depends on constitution, on 1,000 things. But the late discoveries of medical science have given us large powers of alleviation. My father, said Margaret, trembling all over. I do not know, Mr. Hale. I mean, it is difficult to give advice. But I should say, bear on with the knowledge you have forced me to give you so abruptly, till the fact which I could not withhold has become in some degree familiar to you, so that you may, without too great an effort, be able to give what comfort you can to your father. Before then, my visits, which of course I shall repeat from time to time, although I fear I can do nothing but alleviate, 1,000 little circumstances will have occurred to awaken his alarm, to deepen it, so that he will be all the better prepared. Nay, my dear young lady, nay. I saw Mr. Thornton, and I honour your father for the sacrifice he has made. However mistaken I believe him to be. Well, this once, if it will please you, my dear. Only remember, when I come again, I come as a friend, and you must learn to look upon me as such, because seeing each other, getting to know each other at such times as these, is worth years of mourning calls. Margaret could not speak for crying, but she wrung his hand at parting. That's what I call a fine girl, thought Dr. Donaldson, when he was seated in his carriage, and had time to examine his ringed hand, which had slightly suffered from her pressure. Who would have thought that little hand could have given such a squeeze? But the bones were all put together, and that gives immense power. What a queen she is, with her head thrown back at first to force me into speaking the truth, and then bent so eagerly forward to listen. Poor thing. I must see she does not overstrain herself. Though it's astonishing how much these thoroughbred creatures can do and suffer. That girl's game to the backbone. Another, who had gone that deadly colour, could never have come round without fainting or hysterics. But she wouldn't do either. Not she. And the very force of her will brought her round. Such a girl as that would win my heart if I were 30 years younger. It's too late now, of course. Ah, here we are at the Arches. So he jumped out with thought, wisdom, experience, sympathy, and ready to attend to any of the calls made upon him by this family, just as if there were none other in the world. Meanwhile, Margaret had returned into her father's study for a moment, to recover strength before going upstairs into her mother's presence. Oh my God, my God, this is terrible. How shall I bear it? Such a deadly disease. No hope. Oh, Mama, I wish I had never gone to Aunt Shaw's and been all those precious years away from you. Poor Mama. How much she must have borne. Oh, pray thee, my God, that her sufferings may not be too acute, too dreadful. How shall I bear to see them? How can I bear Papa's agony? He must not be told yet, not all at once. It would kill him. But I won't lose another moment of my own dear, precious mother. She ran upstairs. Dixon was not in the room. Mrs. Hale lay back in an easy chair, with a soft white shawl wrapped around her, and a becoming cap put on, in expectation of the doctor's visit. Her face had a little faint colour in it, and the very exhaustion after the examination gave it a peaceful look. Margaret was surprised to see her look so calm. "Why, Margaret, how strange you look. What is the matter?" And then, as the idea stole into her mind of what was indeed the real state of the case, she added, as if a little displeased, "You have not been seeing Dr. Donaldson and asking him any questions, have you, child?" Margaret did not reply, only looked wistfully towards her. Mrs. Hale became more displeased. "He would not surely break his word to me, and..." "Oh yes, Mama, he did. I made him. It was I. Blame me." She knelt down by her mother's side and caught her hand. She would not let it go, though Mrs. Hale tried to pull it away. She kept kissing it, and the hot tears she shed bathed it. "Margaret, it was very wrong of you. You knew I did not wish you to know." But, as if tired with the contest, she left her hand in Margaret's clasp, and by she returned the pressure faintly. That encouraged Margaret to speak. "Oh, Mama, let me be your nurse. I will learn anything Dixon can teach me. But you know I am your child, and I do think I have a right to do everything for you." "You don't know what you're asking," said Mrs. Hale, with a shudder. "Yes, I do. I know a great deal more than you are aware of. Let me be your nurse. Let me try, at any rate. No one has ever, shall ever, try so hard as I will do. It will be such a comfort, Mama." "My poor child. Well, you shall try. Do you know, Margaret, Dixon and I quite thought you would shrink from me if you knew." "Dixon thought," said Margaret, her lips curling. "Dixon could not give me credit for enough true love, for as much as herself. She thought, I suppose, that I was one of those poor sickly women who like to lie on rose leaves and be fanned all day. Don't let Dixon's fancies come any more between you and me, Mama. Don't, please, she implored. Don't be angry with Dixon, said Mrs. Hale, anxiously. Margaret recovered herself. No, I won't. I will try and be humble and learn her ways. If you will only let me do all I can for you. Let me be in the first place, Mother. I am greedy of that. I used to fancy you would forget me while I was away at Aunt Shaw's, and cry myself to sleep at night with that notion in my head. And I used to think, how will Margaret bear our makeshift poverty after the thorough comfort and luxury in Harley Street, till I have many a time been more ashamed of your seeing our contrivances at Helston than of any stranger's finding them out. Oh, Mama, and I did so enjoy them. They were so much more amusing than all the jog-trot Harley Street ways. The wardrobe shelf, with handles that served as a supper tray on grand occasions, and the old tea chests, stuffed and covered for ottomans. I think what you call the makeshift contrivances at dear Helston were a charming part of the life there. I shall never see Helston again, Margaret, said Mrs. Hale, the tears welling up in her eyes. Margaret could not reply. Mrs. Hale went on. While I was there, I was forever wanting to leave it. Every place seemed pleasanter. And now I shall die far away from it. I am rightly punished. You must not talk so, said Margaret impatiently. He said you might live for years. Oh, Mother, we will have you back at Helston yet. No, never, that I must take as a just penance. But Margaret, Frederick. At the mention of that one word, she suddenly cried out loud, as in some sharp agony. It seemed as if the thought of him upset all her composure, destroyed the calm, overcame the exhaustion. Wild, passionate cry succeeded to cry. Frederick, Frederick, come to me. I am dying. Little first-born child, come to me once again. She was in violent hysterics. Margaret went and called Dixon in terror. Dixon came up in a huff and accused Margaret of having overexcited her mother. Margaret bore all meekly, only trusting that her father might not return. In spite of her alarm, which was even greater than the occasion warranted, she obeyed all Dixon's directions promptly and well, without a word of self-justification. By so doing, she mollified her accuser. They put her mother to bed, and Margaret sat by her till she fell asleep, and afterwards till Dixon beckoned her out of the room, and, with a sour face as if doing something against the grain. She bade her drink a cup of coffee, which she had prepared for her in the drawing room, and stood over her in a commanding attitude as she did so. "You shouldn't have been so curious, miss, and then you wouldn't have needed to fret before your time. It would have come soon enough. And now, I suppose, you'll tell master, and a pretty household I shall have of you." "No, Dixon," said Margaret, sorrowfully. "I will not tell Papa. He could not bear it as I can." And by way of proving how well she bore it, she burst into tears. I knew how it would be. Now you'll waken your mamma, just after she's gone to sleep so quietly. Miss Margaret, my dear, I've had to keep it down this many a week, and though I don't pretend I can love her as you do, yet I loved her better than any other man, woman, or child. No one but Master Frederick ever came near her in my mind. Ever since Lady Beresford's maid first took me in to see her dressed out in white crepe, and corn ears, and scarlet poppies, and I ran a needle down into my finger, and broke it in, and she tore up her working pocket handkerchief, after they'd cut it out, and came in to wet the bandages again with lotion when she returned from the ball, where she'd been the prettiest young lady of all. I've never loved anyone like her. I little thought then that I should live to see her brought so low. I don't mean no reproach to nobody. Many a one calls you pretty and handsome, and what not. Even in this smoky place, enough to blind one's eyes, the owls can see that. But you'll never be like your mother for beauty. Never. Not if you live to be 100. Mamma is very pretty still. Poor mamma. Now don't ye set off again, or I shall give way at last. You'll never stand master's coming home and questioning at this rate. Go out and take a walk, and come in something like. Many's the time I've longed to walk it off. The thought of what was the matter with her, and how it must all end. "Old Dixon," said Margaret, "how often I've been cross with you, not knowing what a terrible secret you had to bear." "Bless you, child. I like to see you showing a bit of spirit. It's the good old Beresford blood. Why, the last Sir John but two shot his steward down, there where he stood, for just telling him that he racked the tenants. And he'd racked the tenants till he could get no more money of them than he could get skin off a flint." "Well, Dixon, I won't shoot you, and I'll try not to be cross again." "You never have. If I've said it at times, it's always been to myself, just in private, by way of making a little agreeable conversation, for there's no one here fit to talk to. And when you fire up, you're the very image of Master Frederick. I could find in my heart to put you in a passion any day just as to see his stormy look coming like a great cloud over your face. But now you go out, miss. I'll watch over missus. And as for master, his books are company enough for him if he should come in. I will go, said Margaret. She hung about Dixon for a minute or so, as if afraid and irresolute. Then, suddenly kissing her, she went quickly out of the room. Bless her, said Dixon. She's as sweet as a nut. There are three people I love. It's Mrs. Master Frederick and her. Just them three. That's all. The rest be hanged, for I don't know what they're in the world for. Master was born, I suppose, for to marry Mrs. If I thought he loved her properly, I might get to love him in time. But he should have had made a deal more on her, and not been always reading, reading, thinking, thinking. See what it had brought him to. Many a one who never reads or thinks either gets to be a rector and dean and what not. And I dare say master might, if he'd just minded missus, and let the weary reading and thinking alone. There she goes, looking out of the window as she heard the front door shut. Poor young lady. Her clothes look shabby to what they did when she came to Helston a year ago. Then she hadn't so much as a darned stocking or a cleaned pair of gloves in all her wardrobe. And now... Chapter 17. What is a strike? There are briars besetting every path which call for patient care. There is a cross in every lot, and an earnest need for prayer. Anon. Margaret went out heavily and unwilling enough, but the length of a street, yes, the air of a Milton Street, cheered her young blood before she reached her first turning. Her step grew lighter, her lip redder. Instead of having her thoughts turned so exclusively inward, she saw unusual loiterers in the streets. Men with their hands in their pockets, sauntering along. Loud laughing and loud-spoken girls clustered together, apparently excited to high spirits. And a boisterous independence of temper and behaviour. The more ill-looking of the men, the discreditable minority, hung about on the steps of the beer houses and gin shops, smoking and commenting pretty freely on every passer-by. Margaret disliked the prospect of the long walk through these streets before she came to the fields which she had planned to reach. Instead, she would go and see Bessie Higgins. It would not be so refreshing as a quiet country walk, but still, it would perhaps be doing the kinder thing. Nicholas Higgins was sitting by the fire, smoking as she went in. Bessie was rocking herself on the other side. Nicholas took the pipe out of his mouth and standing up, pushed his chair towards Margaret. He leant against the chimney piece in a lounging attitude, while she asked Bessie how she was.
"Who's rather down in mouth in regards to spirits, but who's better in health? Who doesn't like this strike? Who's a deal too much set on peace and quietness at any price? This is the third strike I've seen," said she, sighing, as if that was answer and explanation enough.
"Well, third time pays for all. See if we don't dang to masters this time. See if they don't come and beg us to come back to our own price. That's all. We've missed it aforetime, I grant you. But this time, we'll lay our plans desperate deep."
"Why do you strike?" asked Margaret. "Striking is leaving off work till you get your own weight of wages, is it not? You must not wonder at my ignorance. Where I come from, I never heard of a strike."
"I wish I were there," said Bessie, wearily. "But it's not for me to get sick and tired of strikes. This is the last I'll see, before it's ended. I shall be in the great city, the holy Jerusalem."
"Who's so full of the life to come, who cannot think of the present? Now, I, you see, am bounded to do the best I can here. I think a bird in the sky is worth two in the bush. So them's the different views we can take on to strike question."
"But," said Margaret, "if the people struck, as you call it, where I come from, as they are mostly all field labourers, the seed would not be sown, the hay got in, the corn reaped."
"Well," said he. He had resumed his pipe and put his "well" in the form of an interrogation.
"Why," she went on, "what would become of the farmers?" He puffed away.
"I reckon they'd have either to give up their farms or give fair rates of wage."
"Suppose they could not or would not do the last. They could not give up their farms all in a minute, however much they might wish to do so. But they would have no hay, no corn to sell that year. And where would the money come from to pay the labourers' wages the next?"
Still puffing away, at last he said,
"I know naught of your ways down south, but I've heard there's a pack of spiritless, downtrodden men. Well, you clemmed to the death, too dazed with clemming to know when they're put on. Now, it's not so here. We known when we're put upon, and we'n too much blood in us to stand it. We just take our hands from our looms and say, 'You may clem us, but you'll not put upon us, my master.' And be danged to 'em, they shan't this time."
"I wish I lived in the south," said Bessie.
"There's a deal to bear there," said Margaret. "There are sorrows to bear everywhere. There is very hard bodily labour to be gone through, with very little food to give strength."
"But it's out of doors," said Bessie, "and away from the endless, endless noise and sickening heat. It's sometimes in heavy rain, and sometimes in bitter cold. A young person can stand it, but an old man gets racked with rheumatism and bent and withered before his time. Yet he must just work on the same, or else go to the workhouse. I thought you were so taken with the ways of the South Country. So I am, said Margaret, smiling a little, as she found herself thus caught. I only mean, Bessie, there's good and bad in everything in this world, and as you felt the bad up here, I thought it was but fair you should know the bad down there. And you say there's never a strike down there, said Nicholas, abruptly. No, said Margaret, I think they have too much sense. And I think, replied he, dashing the ashes out of his pipe with so much vehemence that it broke, it's not that they've too much sense, but that they've too little spirit. Oh, father, said Bessie, what have you gained by striking? Just think of that first strike when mother died, and we all had to clem. You the worst of all, and yet many a one went in every week at the same wage, till all were gone in that there were work for, and some went beggars all their lives after. Aye, said he, that there strike was badly managed. Folk got in with management of it, as were either fools or not true men. You'll see. It'll be different this time. But all this time, you've not told me what you're striking for, said Margaret again. Why, you see, there's 5 or 6 masters who have set themselves again paying the wages they've been paying these 2 years past, and flourishing upon, and getting richer upon. And now they come to us, and they say we're to take less. And we won't. We'll just clem them to death first, and see who'll work for 'em then. They'll have killed the goose that laid the golden eggs for 'em, I reckon. And so you plan dying in order to be revenged upon them. No, said he, I do not. I just look forward to the chance of dying at my post sooner than yielding. That's what folk call fine and honourable in a soldier, and why not in a poor weaver chap? But, said Margaret, a soldier dies in the cause of the nation, in the cause of others. He laughed grimly. My lass, said he, you're but a young wench, but don't you think I can keep 3 people, that's Bessie and Mary and me, on 16 shillings a week? Don't you think it's myself I'm striking for at this time? It is just as much in the cause of others as yon soldier. Only mappin, the cause he dies for is just that of somebody he never clapped his eyes on, nor heard on all his born days. While I take up John Boche's cause, as lives next door but one, with a sickly wife and 8 children, none of 'em factory age. And I don't take up his cause only, though he's a poor good-for-naught as can only manage 2 looms at a time. But I take up the cause of justice. Why are we to have less now, I asked, than 2 years ago? Don't ask me, said Margaret. I am very ignorant. Ask some of your masters. Surely they will give you a reason for it. It is not merely an arbitrary decision of theirs, come to without reason. You're just a foreigner,
and nothing more, said he, contemptuously. Much you know about it. Ask the masters. They'd tell us to mind our own business, and they'd mind theirs. Our business being, you understand, to take the bated wage and to be thankful, and their business to bait us down, to clem in point, to swell their profits. That's what it is. But, said Margaret, determined not to give way, although she saw she was irritating him. The state of trade may be such as not to enable them to give you the same remuneration. State of trade? That's just a piece of master's humbug. It's rate of wages I was talking of. To masters keep the state of trade in their own hands and just walk it forwards like a black bugaboo to frighten naughty children with into being good. I'll tell you it's their part, their cue, as some folks call it, to beat us down, to swell their fortunes. And it's ours to stand up and fight hard, not for ourselves alone, but for them around about us, for justice and fair play. We ought to make their profits, and we ought to help to spend them. It's not that we want the brass so much this time, as we've done many a time afore. We're getting money laid by, and we're resolved to stand and fall together. Not a man on us will give in for less wages than t' union says is due. So I say, hooray for the strike. And let Thornton and Slickson and Amper and their set look to it. Thornton, said Margaret. Mr. Thornton of Marlborough Street. Aye, Thornton of Marlborough Mill, as we call him. He is one of the masters you are striving with, is he not? What sort of master is he? Do you ever see a bulldog? Set a bulldog on hind legs and dress him up in a coat and breeches, and you'll just get in, John Thornton. Nay, said Margaret, laughing. I deny that. Mr. Thornton is plain enough, but he's not like a bulldog, with its short, broad nose and snarling upper lip. No, not in look, I grant you. But let John Thornton get hold of you on a notion, and he'll stick to it like a bulldog. You might pull him away with a pitchfork before he'd let go. He's worth fighting with, is John Thornton. As for Slickson, I take it, some of these days he'll wheedle his men back with fair promises, that they'll just get cheated out of as soon as they're in the power again. He'll work his fines well out on them, I'll warrant. He's as slippery as an eel. He's like a cat, as sleek and cunning and fierce. There'll never be an honest up and down fight with him, as it will be with Thornton. Thornton's as dour as a doornail, an obstinate chap, every inch on him, that bulldog. Poor Bessie, said Margaret, turning round to her. You sigh over it all. You don't like struggling and fighting as your father does, do you? No, said she, heavily. I'm sick on it. I could have wished to have had other talk about me in my latter days, but just come the clashing and clanging and clattering that has ever wearied my life long. About work, and wages, and masters, and hands, and knobsticks. Poor wench, latter days be farred. Thou'rt looking a sight better already for a little stir and change. Besides, I shall be a deal here to make it more lively for thee.
Tobacco smoke chokes me, said she, querulously.
Then I'll never smoke it no more into house, he replied, tenderly. But why didst thou not tell me afore, thou foolish wench?
She did not speak for a while, and then so low that only Margaret heard her.
I reckon he'll want all the comfort he can get out of either a pipe or a drink afore he's done.
Her father went out of doors, evidently to finish his pipe. Bessie said passionately,
Now am not I a fool, am I not, miss? There, I knew I ought to for keep my father at home, and away from the folk that are always ready for a tempt a man, in times a strike, to go drink. And there my tongue must needs crawl with this pipe of his, and he'll go off, and I know he will, as often as he wants to smoke, and nobody knows where it'll end. I wish I'd letten myself be choked first.
But does your father drink? Said Margaret.
No, not to say drink, replied she, still in the same wild, excited tone. But what would ye have? There are days with you, as with other folk, I suppose, when you get up and go through to hours, just longing for a bit of change, a bit of a fillip, as it were. And I know I'd gone and bought a 4-pounder out of another baker's shop to common on such days, just because I sickened at the thought of going on forever with the same sight in me eyes, and the same sound in me ears, and the same taste in me mouth, and the same thought, or no thought for that matter, in me head, day after day, forever. I've longed for to be a man to go spreeing, even if it were only a tramp to some new place in search of work. And father, all men have it stronger in them than me to get tired of the sameness and work forever. And what is them to do? It's little blame to them if they do go into the gin shop for to make their blood flow quicker and more lively, and see things they never see at no other time. Pictures, and looking glass, and such like. But father never was a drunkard, though maybe he's got worse for drink now and then. Only you see. And now her voice took a mournful, pleading tone. At times a strike, there's much to knock a man down. For all they start so hopeful. And where's the comfort to come from? They'll get angry and mad. They all do. And then they get tired with being angry and mad. And maybe have done things in their passion they'd be glad to forget. Bless your sweet pitiful face. But you do not know what a strike is yet.
Come, Bessie, said Margaret. I won't say you're exaggerating, because I don't know enough about it. But perhaps, as you're not well, you're only looking on one side, and there is another and a brighter to be looked to.
It's all well enough for you to say so, who have lived in pleasant green places all your life long. Never known want or care, or wickedness either, for that matter.
Take care, said Margaret, her cheek flushing, and her eye lightening. How you judge, Bessie? I shall go home to my mother, who is so ill, Bessie, that there's no outlet but death for her out of a prison of her great suffering. And yet I must speak cheerfully to my father, who has no notion of her real state, and to whom the knowledge must come gradually. The only person, the only one who could sympathize with me and help me, whose presence could comfort my mother more than any other earthly thing, is falsely accused, would run the risk of death if he came to see his dying mother. This I tell you, only you, Bessie. You must not mention it. No other person in Milton, hardly any other person in England knows. Have I not care? Do I not know anxiety, though I go about well dressed and have good food enough? Oh, Bessie, God is just, and our lots are well portioned out by him, although none by he knows the bitterness of our souls. I ask your pardon, replied Bessie, humbly. Sometimes, when I've thought of my life, and the little pleasure I've had in it, I believe that, maybe, I was one of those doomed to die by the falling of a star from heaven, and the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and men died of the waters because they were made bitter. One can bear pain and sorrow better if one thinks it's been prophesied long before one. Somehow, then it seems as if my pain were needn't for the fulfillment. Otherwise, it seems all sent for nothing. Nay, Bessie, think, said Margaret. God does not willingly inflict. Don't dwell so much on the prophecies, but read the clearer parts of the Bible. I dare say it would be wiser, but where would I hear such grand words of promise? Hear tell her anything so far different from this dreary world and this town as in Revelations? Many's the time I've repeated the verses in the 7th chapter to myself, just for the sound. It's as good as an organ, and as different from every day too. No, I cannot give up Revelations. It gives me more comfort than any other book in the Bible. Let me come and read you some of my favourite chapters. Aye, she said greedily. Come, father will maybe hear you. He's deaved with me talking. He says it's all naught to do with things of today, and that's his business. Where is your sister? Gone fustin' cutting. I were loath to let her go, but somehow, we must live. The union can't afford as much. Now I must go. You have done me good, Bessie. I done you good? Yes. I came here very sad, and rather too apt to think of my own cause for grief was the only one in the world. And now I hear how you have had to bear for years, and that makes me stronger. Bless you, I thought of ye the good doing was on the side of the gentlefolk. I shall get proud if I think I can do good to you. You won't do it if you think about it. But you'll only puzzle yourself if you do. That's one comfort. You're not like no one I ever seed. I don't know what to make of you. Nor I of myself. Goodbye. Bessie stilled her rocking to gaze after her. I wonder if there are many folk like her down south. She's like a breath of country air, somehow. She freshens me up and above a bit. Who'd have thought that face, as bright and as strong as the angel I dream of, could have known the sorrow she speaks on? I wonder how she'll sin. All on us must sin. I think a deal on her, for sure. But Father does the like, I see. And Mary even. It's not often who's stirred up to notice much.